Time once again on the program for us to delve into the realm of the world's music, discovering yet another song or piece of music that changed the world. This is our series, 20 Pieces of Music That Changed the World. Number 7 on our list, our guide, of course, is Robert Harris, and he's with me in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. This is number 7 in the series. What is changing the world this morning?
Well, I get the sense when we do this, although you may correct me, that you're always a little miffed at the end of every item because you say, what's next? And I always say, I'm not going to tell you.
It's a surprise, yes. Yeah,
well, in fact, I am going to tell you because...
Really? Then I won't be miffed.
I hope. Because what I want to do for the next 3, 7, 8, and 9 is basically look at a single theme in the history of music. And that theme is the conjunction of the music of Africa and the music of the West. Three times in music history when these two chemicals came together, creating an explosion in music history, three explosions that changed the world. Today, we're going to look at the first of those, and that's the invention of jazz and how jazz changed the world.
It was, in fact, wasn't it in the early, early days, it was called African music, wasn't
well,
it?
Yeah, well, it is
in a derogatory sort of way.
But it is, in fact, in a very positive sort of way. So today we're looking at jazz.
Okay.
Next time we're going to look at reggae, that combination of Jamaican and European music. And the time after that, we're going to look at rap. Rap music of the 80s.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
Well, you're going to be surprised, I promise you. These
All
are
right.
three explosive TNT musical events.
Okay.
So, the first is jazz. And probably the most significant, in a way, of all of these three, again, in terms of how long this explosion has reverberated in the world. And trying to find jazz recordings that change the world is really not that hard, actually. I could have picked, I'm not picking, but I could have picked a recording like this. So this is one of the first jazz recordings ever made. This is the original Dixieland Jazz Band. On their original labels, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, J-A-S-S, who sprung jazz on the world.
What era? What epoch are we talking?
February 26th of 1917. That's when this record was made.
Wow.
Almost exactly 92 years ago.
That's right.
So it's almost 100 years ago. The world never really recovered from this recording. Interestingly, jazz had been around for a while, but jazz is completely tied up with the recording business. So these records changed the world. And the proof of that, if you want nothing more, the decade that followed was called the Jazz Age. So that's what the 20s was called, the Jazz Age, because there was something in this music that we're about to hear, in its sensibility, in its rhythms, in its spirit, something in it that was absolutely world-changing. So this is where we're starting. It's not where we're ending. So take a listen. This is called Ostrich Walk. This one was released in 1919, not in 1917. But this is the original Dixieland Jazz Band. The impact is exactly the same.
That's Ostrich Walk, the original Dixieland Jazz Band. That's from 1919.
That's a new sound. It's hard to imagine now how incredibly revolutionary that sound was in the world. We're just after World War I, right? And just before the war, until this sound broke upon the world, we were dancing waltzes and minuets, and all of a sudden this raucous, exciting, rhythmic-filled music invaded the world, and it just changed the way people thought about life in general.
And the term Dixieland, it came out of the South.
That's right.
And it came out of the Black South.
That's exactly right.
New Orleans and
precisely
all of that.
So,
was it an offshoot of minstrelsy?
It partly,
in a way.
Okay, let's try it. Let's set it in place.
Yeah,
New Orleans.
All right.
Okay. So what it is, whether white people play it or black people play it, what jazz is as I say, is a conjunction of two musical worlds. It's a hybrid. What we've learned in music going way back to Gregorian chant is that, I guess like in biology, hybrids really are exciting. So what jazz is European harmonies, like the chords that people use.
Right.
That comes from Western classical music. And the instruments they use are Western. Piano, trumpet, cornet, flute, saxophone, they're all Western instruments. What they took from Africa was the rhythmic sense, this undefinable, syncopated, easygoing, incredibly complicated rhythms, the swing element.
Mm-hmm.
So that we put these two together and you've got jazz. So why did it happen in New Orleans? Well, it happened in New Orleans because New Orleans was a sophisticated, essentially still a French city. You know, we Canadians, I'm here to say, you know, how important we are to the history of music and of American culture. Right? Jazz is French in a way, because New Orleans, of course, was settled by the Acadians who went down into
the expulsion.
What was then still a French city. So it had an incredible sophistication. You were likely to hear in New Orleans symphonies, operas in 1900, quadrilles, waltzes. So you had that enormous European influence. And then you've got at the same time field hollers, the blues, black gospel music, all in the same place and the same time. Jazz was this extraordinarily fruitful combination of the two. And why? Where European music was strong, African music is weak. So African music is basically a rhythmic music with a single voice. European music has great harmonies and great complexity. European music, we have the worst sense of rhythm in the world, right? I mean, like, what is our greatest piece? Beethoven's Fifth. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da. It's like boring as it can be. So jazz took the rhythmic complexity of African music, where European is weak, and added the European strength. And all of a sudden, we had a fantastically exciting kind of music. So we started with the original Dixieland Jazz Band, but we're not going to end with them because that, in fact, is not the cut I'm choosing that changed the world. The cut that I'm choosing that changed the world was by Louis Louis Armstrong, okay?
Now, let's settle the debate right here and now. It is Louis Armstrong.
It is definitely Louis Armstrong, and it's interesting why it's Louis Armstrong.
Why? Because that was his name.
Well, that was his name, but it's interesting why we don't think it's Louis Armstrong. Here's the proof if anybody wants to know. Hello, Dolly, this is Louis.
Yeah.
Dolly, that's his name, okay?
Right.
But for my generation, he was known as Louis Armstrong. You know, when he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, here's Louis Armstrong, here's Louis Armstrong. But here's the difference. So New Orleans is a city of many ethnicities. The black population, there's a black population and there's what's called a Creole population. The Creole population is, of course, the intermarriage of French and black. So if you're a Creole, and had Armstrong been a Creole, his name would be Louis. It would be pronounced in a French way. We're going to hear him in a moment with Sidney Bechet, B-E-C-H-E-T, pronounced Bechet, because Bechet came from a Creole family. Armstrong came from a black family. So for him, it was a big difference to be called Louis.
In the 40s and 50s, I listened to old radio shows in which Louis Armstrong was on, and if the announcer didn't know whether it was Louis or Louis, he satisfied it by just saying Pops.
Exactly.
Hey, Pops.
Well, he was Pops, he was Dippermouth, he was Satch. Here's the thing about Louis Armstrong. Because of Armstrong's skill, jazz turned into an art that was at the level of classical art. When he got to West End Blues in 1928, which is the cut that we're going to hit, that's the one I'm picking that changed the world. Let's trace that evolution in a couple of steps. Dixieland jazz is interesting because it's a very democratic art. That cut we heard.
In what way?
Everybody plays at the same time. There's no real leader. There's no soloist. Everybody is basically equal in Dixieland jazz, in the traditional Dixieland jazz. Armstrong started to change that almost just because of his own personal skill and because his musicality was so much greater than even the most skilled of his contemporaries. He invented the idea of the soloist, the first among equals. I want us to listen to a song. I don't know if you know this one. It's called Cakewalking Babies from Home. This has got a vocal in it, okay? Eva Taylor. This was made in January of 1925. And what's interesting about this cut is that it features two great jazz soloists, Louis Armstrong on the cornet and Sidney Bechet playing the soprano saxophone, what it sounds like a clarinet. The two of them are sort of in competition with one another, trying to outdo one another while they're playing. Armstrong wins. Louis starts playing the melody. Bechet, you'll hear in the background, there's a trombone part, there's a banjo, you'll hear a voice. Listen to the very end, okay? This is music that brings tears to my eyes every time I listen to it. Here's Armstrong and Cakewalking Babies from Home. So there's Louis playing the melody. And if you listen carefully, you can hear sort of a clarinet in the background. That's Bechet. And there's so much flexibility in Armstrong's playing. Just follow him. Another chorus is coming. And here comes the vocal by Eva Taylor. She's coming to an end. You can almost hear Armstrong and Bechet just getting ready. Here they come. You can hear a bit more of Bechet here. And he has a bit of a solo right here. No slouch as a player, Sidney Bechet, but he's about to be blown out of the water. Here's Armstrong's final chorus. Just listen to this. So much joy here.
That's from 1925, Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet, Cakewalking Babies from Home. Now, the other element about jazz, though, is improvisation.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing I was about to mention. He's sort of making that up.
He's getting there. Yeah.
He's making it up as he goes along.
Yeah.
Now, as I say, what is improvisation? So, right at the moment, I have a script in front of me, right, where I, in fact, wrote down some of the things that I wanted to say today. If you compare the script that I wrote and what I've actually said, they're different.
Yeah, of course.
Because I'm improvising.
Yeah.
So what am I doing? Taking ideas that I've sort of formed, but in conversation with you, they come out in a different way. That's improvisation. If we did this item again,
it would be different.
It would be different. That's improvisation. But what I love about that is Armstrong is 24 years old, okay? And it's so joyous. He's just bursting with energy. There is so much brashness in there. And it is improvised, so he is making it up as he's going along. But what's interesting, again, is the African and European. What's African about that is whether a white person is playing it or a black person playing it, or a child, it doesn't make any difference who's playing it. The roots of musical arts is that ease, that da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's that syncopation. We now take this for granted. No one took it for granted in 1925. Lewis had this incredible rhythmic ability. And that last moment goes, yep, like you can just feel, I can, I hope others can as well, just the gorgeous energy that comes out of a 70, 80-year-old recording. So we start with Cakewalking Baby. This is 1925. But the recordings that made Armstrong's reputation were the recordings he made with a studio group called the Hot Five and then the Hot Seven. What was so important about the Hot Five? This is when Armstrong's solo efforts as a front rank musician came into being. And what's so interesting, and we may play this one twice, is his solos were constructed as though he had written them out. He is improvising them. He's making them up. But they had an extraordinary form and shape. It wasn't just one note after another. It wasn't just somebody, you know, I can improvise on the piano. I mean, if we had a piano in here, I could just go and play anything at random, and I would say improvise. Yeah. And the reason it wouldn't be very good is there'd be no organization to it.
Well, he fit. Everything he did fit.
Absolutely.
In the context.
Exactly. But how that worked and why that worked is really, really interesting to hear. So I want us to hear Potato Head Blues. We're not yet at the cut that changed the world, but we're coming. Potato Head Blues.
Wonderful piece.
And what's especially interesting is the very end when Armstrong's solo. And I think we may, in fact, play that twice. So he begins, we'll hear the rest of the instruments, listen to what he does at the very end. Okay, here's Potato Head Blues. This is sort of a Dixieland opening. And here's Louis' first solo. Just listen to the brashness of this sound, right? This is Johnny Dodds, the clarinet player. Not a bad musician, not in the same league as we. Pretty square. There's this banjo solo, and here's Armstrong's solo. Thank you.
Louis Armstrong and the Hot Five, and the Hot Seven, I think. That was Potato Head Blues. And you are listening to the Sunday Edition here on CBC Radio 1 across Canada with Robert Harris. We are looking at yet another piece of music that changed the world. This morning we're looking at jazz.
Now, I wanted to actually play that solo again, if you don't
mind. Let's go back and play it again.
And I want to show you why. I mean, if you feel, when you hear it the first time, it feels satisfying. Here's what Armstrong is doing. Whether he's aware of this or not, the human ear notes the highest note in a melody. Sort of unconsciously, we pay attention to the highest note of a melody. And many of the melodies we've been talking about, we mentioned this in We Shall Overcome, for some reason we register the highest note. What Armstrong does in his solo very consciously is he keeps making the highest note higher and higher and higher until we don't think it can get higher anymore. I want to show you how he does this so you can understand why this man is a genius. Okay, here comes this little banjo interlude. So here's Armstrong. So that's where the highest note. Now it goes down a bit. Goes down. He's moved the highest note higher. And higher again. Goes down a bit. Going higher. Keeps going higher. Now listen right here. Even higher. And now it hits the highest note, we think. Like a real high note. And we think we've got to the top. Now listen right here. Whip up. It's unbelievable to me.
You talk about, you talk about Louis Armstrong's energy and all that.
Right.
But there's also the humor.
Absolutely. There's humor.
Good humor.
Well,
the man.
He has a great musical sense of humor. That last thing, so he's going higher and higher. Again, whether we recognize this or not, but at the very end, he's hit that da, which we think is the highest note because he's given it such a prominence. And then it goes, yup, which is like four notes higher. Yeah. This is, again, done on the fly, but done with a mind that as he began that solo a minute earlier, he's like a chess player. You know what are great chess players? Great chess players are people who can see 10 moves ahead. A great improviser is somebody who can start a solo and I've already heard sort of how it's going to end. But there is that sense of humor and this enormous sense of passion. So now we're coming finally.
Sorry
so long. To the kind of music that changed the world. And this is West End Blues. So what's so important about
this is West End Blues.
West End Blues. 1928 now.
Okay.
And why did this change the world? It changed the world for a couple of reasons. Number one, it took that sound. I mean, we're so used to jazz improvisation now. We can't remember. It's hard for us to understand how new these were. Miles Davis said that there has nothing ever been done in jazz that Louis Armstrong didn't do in his first 10 recordings, ever. And he was right. These recordings were revolutionary.
Sure.
West End Blues takes that black sound and the European sound and puts them together in an extraordinary way and made popular music into an art. Remember we were talking about Caruso a few weeks back.
In the hotel room.
But making those records and what those records by Caruso proved to the world is that the record was something of value, not just a novelty. West End Blues proved to the world that popular music could be as artistic as art, as high art.
But it also proved that so-called jungle music could be popular.
Yeah, exactly. Both
so
at the same
yeah.
time. And it's interesting because Armstrong listened to Caruso records. Those Caruso records that we were listening to, he listened to.
Really?
Yes, and admitted it. He was one of the first musicians who had part of his musical education through records. He was 17 years old when he got his first gramophone, and he loved Caruso. And you'll hear Caruso because the beginning of West End Blues may be the most famous 12 seconds in the history of jazz. It's a cadenza.
And a cadenza is?
A cadenza is basically a solo performance that is sort of out of time with the rest of it. It's showing the performer's virtuosity.
It's also shocking.
It's very shocking.
It's shocking when you hear it.
We're going to listen to it more than once.
What's he doing?
Exactly. So why don't we listen just to the beginning of West End Blues, and then I will take you through the rest. This is 3 minutes of perfection that you would hear before this in Beethoven, in Mozart, in Verdi, but not in popular music. So here is just the opening to West End Blues. Thank you. That is so unbelievable, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, again, it goes by real fast, right? So people have tried to do it, have tried to recreate that.
Yeah.
Impossible. Try to beat your hand to it. Impossible. This is Armstrong. What is it? It's a musician. I think of Beethoven. When you read the stories of Beethoven first coming into Vienna at almost exactly the same age, 23, 24, and having this extraordinary power and showing it off, right?
Yeah.
This is what that thing is. That thing is a call to arms. It is, here I am. I don't know how to explain.
Revolutionary.
It is unbelievably revolutionary. So now we're going to listen to that and listen to the rest of it because it doesn't continue in that vein at all.
No, I know. The first time I heard it, I thought I'd come in at the wrong time.
Exactly.
in the piece.
Exactly. It comes out of nowhere. There's not another cut like it in all of jazz,
yeah.
Really. So here's West End Blues, the cut that changed the world. Now it settles into this very easy blues, right? And just listen to his tone color.
That's rocking chair blues.
Exactly. So much ease in Armstrong's playing. Beautiful ascending line. Now here's the trombone player. So after that extraordinary opening, we're sort of going back in the history of jazz to a real down south feeling. Listen to what comes next, because now we hear Armstrong singing with a clear. Listen. So beautiful. His voice is so beautiful. All made up on the go, right?
That's early scat, isn't
yeah,
it? Early
exactly.
Scat singing.
Exactly. Now this is Earl Hines playing the piano, and we're setting up Louis' solo. So what is he going to do for his solo after that opening and that gorgeous center? I don't want to ruin Father Hines' solo, but Armstrong does the most surprising thing of all, which you'll hear in a second. Here comes Louis' final solo. And he takes this note, and he holds it, and he holds it, and he holds it, and he holds it. Incredible, huh? It's just amazing to me. So what is
West End Blues.
So there's that solo at the beginning. So here's what Armstrong. So he holds that note at the end, you know, forever, and then he goes da 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 da. At the beginning of the is da 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 da. It's the same piece of music. He's got it all figured out. It's such a beautiful, artistic. See, it's artistic, according to criteria of the highest art. Armstrong didn't just listen to Caruso, he learned from Caruso. So the reason that this cut is world-changing is that it wasn't immediately popular. I mean, what's interesting about all of these Armstrongs, the OK label was for black people only. Armstrong wasn't really well known in the white community for a couple of years later. This was music for black audiences. But when people, musicians, started to listen to, there hasn't been a jazz performer, a rock performer, any vocalist who hasn't learned from these recordings.
Not just vocalists, but instrumentalists.
Everybody.
Everybody has.
I mean, so it's changed the musical world, but it changed the real world because it established the notion that black Americans, that popular music could not only aspire to high art, but actually reach it. Now, a lot of people who love classic music cannot bear jazz. They just don't like it, and they don't get it. I've never understood it, because the two worlds are so similar to one another. And they're similar because they're artistically ambitious. So it changed the world.
All right, sir. Next week, we move into the second of the three elements.
Correct. We're going to look
at reggae.
Reggae. We're going to look at Bob Marley, and we're going to look at the same thing. And this is a case where, for the first time in sort of the modern era, music that is not essentially Western.
You're going to have to educate me on the next two episodes on reggae and rap, because I'm not familiar with either.
Well, I'd be delighted to do that.
I'll just ask you a bunch of dumb questions.
And there'll always be hard ones that I won't be able to answer.
You give me the straight goods, as you always do.
I do my best.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care now. That's Robert Harris. He's our maestro for these 20 pieces of music that changed the world. This is the Sunday edition.